as much as we're glad that Marvin's home, this fight isn't over with.
One member of the Fairbanks Four has been paroled. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 22nd. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, an economist says the state should prepare for a long and painful recession.
I don't think there's much doubt, certainly not in my mind, that this will be the worst recession Alaska's ever experienced.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
One of the four Fairbanks men fighting for exoneration from murder convictions was paroled last week. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Alaska Native community gathered in Fairbanks over the weekend to welcome home Marvin Roberts.
Friends and family sang and danced to celebrate the release of Marvin Roberts. Roberts is one of the so-called Fairbanks Four, men whose convictions for the 1997 beating death of 15-year-old John Hartman have long been questioned. The three others, fellow Alaska Natives George Fries and Eugene Vent, and American Indian Kevin Peace, remain jailed. A request for post-conviction relief, currently working its way through the courts, centers on new information pointing to others being responsible for the Hartman attack. The interior Alaska Native community has increased support for the Fairbanks Four in recent years, something the 37-year-old Roberts recognized in brief comments at the weekend event.
A lot of times in prison, I would try to think of what I would say, like in a situation like this. And now that I'm here, I can't think of nothing. So. But no, on behalf of George, Eugene, and Kevin, and myself and our families, it's from the bottom of our hearts, we just want to say thank you to all of you.
Roberts has been in a halfway house in Fairbanks since last week after transitioning from prisons where he spent the last 17-plus years. Speaking at the Saturday event, Tanana Chiefs Conference President Victor Joseph reflected on the bittersweet feelings of many.
As much as we're glad that Marvin's home, this fight isn't over with. It's not over with yet. Not until all the young men are home, when they are exonerated, when their hearts are free from this bad way that they've been put away. They locked them up, they need to be home free, and when they're exonerated, that's when they'll be free.
Joseph emphasized the importance of the event as a fundraiser for the Alaska Innocence Project, which along with other attorneys is working to exonerate the Fairbanks Four. Their request for post-conviction relief largely hinges on self-incriminating statements by two former Fairbanks men serving time for unrelated killings. Alleged statements by one of those men about the Hartman murder remains under seal of attorney-client privilege, a situation Innocence Project Director Bill Oberle calls very unique.
We couldn't find any precedent anywhere in the United States to cover this situation. So it's kind of a new interpretation of a certain part of the law. And so I understood why the Court of Appeals might take some time. I just didn't think it would be this amount of time.
Oberle remains optimistic justice will prevail, pointing to Roberts' parole despite maintaining his innocence. Oberle is hoping for a ruling releasing the sealed statement prior to an evidentiary hearing in the case scheduled for October. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The state released a report last week with the ominous title, The Great Alaska Recession. It's written by Juno economist Greg Erickson and was commissioned by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. In his analysis, Erickson says the state entered into a recession last summer. He says the recession is likely to be long and deep because it's driven by the drop in the value of the state's number one export, oil. Combined with the declining federal dollars and jobs, military reductions, and a weakened fishing industry, and it adds up to a perfect storm. Erickson told APRN's Lori Townsend, if oil prices rebound, you can shelve his report. But if not,
I don't think there's much doubt, certainly not in my mind, that
this will be the worst recession Alaska's ever experienced. Far worse than what we experienced in the next most worst recession, which was 86-89, which was pretty significant, but which we emerged from pretty strong. The economy emerged pretty robust after it shook the extra capacity out. I showed this report to a number of economists and other experts in draft form, and Scott Goldsmith, who's been a mentor of mine for years, who's probably the most influential economist working today in Alaska, he made a couple of good points. He said, first of all, well, your major point is unassailable. He basically, we're pretty vulnerable. But he made another point. He said, I think what you've got here, Greg, is pretty much a worst case. And, you know, he could be right. He could be right. But I think this is a worst case situation that we're facing.
What did you find regarding the prospect of, you looked into Medicaid expansion. How would expansion impact Alaska's economy over the next 3 to 5 years? What were your findings there?
Well, there's just no doubt that it's sort of a no-brainer from an economic point of view. There's no question that it would help support, one of the things that you want to do in a declining economy is to, particularly in Alaska, is to maximize the federal dollars coming in. Medicaid expansion does that, and in the first year, at least, first years, it's entirely federal dollars that produce that, and you would substantially increase the number of jobs in Alaska, which would offset some of the declines that we're going to see regardless of what we do. Our study indicates, and this is confirmed by studies by Northern Economics and others, that there would be about 1,000 to 1,800 new jobs created in Alaska in the first year after Medicaid expansion. That would, that's not a huge impact. It's 0.25% of the total employment in the state, but it's a plus, and everything else is going to be in minus.
How much does perception impact the economy? You've used some kind of dire words here, collapse and the biggest recession since statehood. If there's a lot of worry about the future, how much impact can that have on investment here or residents getting skittish about staying?
Well, it can have a lot of effect, and that's a matter that I've always often thought about. Really, one of the major things that determines whether an economy grows or stagnates is what's in people's hearts. And I saw that in the 1980s, after the pipeline shut down and construction shut down in the late 70s, there were a lot of dire warnings then. But people had confidence in Alaska, and they stuck it out. That happened also in the early 80s when oil revenue declined for the first time. People seem to want to stay here, and I don't know what's in people's hearts right now, but I suspect that the connections to Alaska are much more tightly economic now than they were before, and if the economy declines, I think it's likely we're going to see more people leaving Alaska. And if oil prices stay low, there's no question we need to be looking ahead to Alaska with fewer people, fewer jobs, and planning for that eventuality can speed the return to growth and lay the groundwork for a more robust recovery, which will eventually come.
Greg Erickson is an economist based in Juneau. He spoke with Laurie Townsend. You can read a copy of his report, The Great Alaska Recession, on our website at alaskapublic.org. Of the throng of Republicans known to be running for president, the state party says Marco Rubio is the first to announce an Alaska team. Anchorage political consultants Art and April Hackney have signed on to lead the Alaska campaign. Rubio, a U.S. senator from Florida, drew some heat this spring when he unveiled his campaign logo. It dots the I in Rubio with an outline of the U.S. map, minus Alaska and Hawaii. Senator Mazie Hirono of a Hawaii Democrat promptly registered her objections on Twitter. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a grant helps Juneau make a digital map of the city cemetery.
It'll be similar in concept to Google Maps, where you enter an address and it takes you to that location. In this case, you'll enter somebody's name and it'll take you to their location in Evergreen Cemetery.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The community of Nalato is beginning evacuations as the Nalato Fire is approaching the new town settlement. The fire started on Sunday just a mile from the community. According to the Alaska Fire Service, it was caused by lightning. Volunteers are taking boats from Galena, about 40 miles upriver, to move people out of the community. Galena-based missionary John Casey is in Nalato, helping out with the firefighting response. He reports that the flame jumped a fire break created over the past day, and winds are now pushing the fire closer to the main residential section of Nalato. Smoke jumpers are on the scene to assist local crews. Dozens of new wildfires are burning around interior and western Alaska as widespread lightning continues to cause new starts. An Alaska Interagency Coordination Center report listed 47 new fires this morning, with 186 active blazes statewide. Among recent days, new fires getting attention are two on either side of the park's highway near Anderson. Firefighters are battling what's been called the Rex Complex fire. The report estimates the combined burned area at nearly 5,000 acres. Fire Information Officer Andrea Capps says the fires have threatened populated areas.
They were very concerned about the Kobiag area when this first started, and of course the residents in Kobiag were very nervous because it's just north of there. Now, fortunately, the wind has been pushing it, at least up until last night, north-northeast, away from Kobiag, which was nice, but of course towards Anderson.
Capps says the Nanana River lies between the fire and the community of Anderson, and a response to the blaze is ramping up as a Type 2 management team from Washington State takes over operations and more resources are diverted to the fire along the park's highway. Many of the other recent new lightning starts are in more remote parts of the interior, but a few are near small communities. A new blaze that started Saturday near Northway along the Alaska Highway has quickly grown to 9,000 acres. Tok Area Division of Forestry spokesman Jim Schwaber says winds are pushing the flames away from the community and parallel to the highway.
The concerns we have is the potential impacts of that fire on the travel corridor there, the important corridor for the traffic on the Alaska Highway. We are making preparations to have flaggers and pilot cars on scene if safety requires their use in order for the traffic to continue flowing there.
The Card Street fire near Sterling on the Kenai Peninsula is 25% contained after destroying 11 structures. The Sockeye fire near Willow is now at 79% contained. Pacrim Coal is proposing a strip mining operation on the west side of Cook Inlet in the Chewitna watershed. It proposes removing the water completely from a tributary on the Chewitna River, which is a salmon stream. On August 21st, there will be a public hearing in Anchorage about the reservation of water applications for the area near the proposed mine. The decision that follows could determine the possible future of the watershed. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
With regard to water rights, Alaska is a prior appropriation state. It follows the logic of first in right, first in time. Basically, the first person to take water from an area for beneficial use gets the rights. David Shady is the chief of water resources for the Department of Natural Resources, or DNR.
In 1984, the legislature allowed reservation water applications, or what some people call in-stream flow reservations. Part of that was that a traditional water right, as long as you perfect that right, use that water, it's a perpetual right. Reservation of water rights are reviewable.
So one is perpetual, one is reviewable. Bob Shavelson, executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, says it was through this process that local citizens first showed their opposition to the mine.
There's been a very strong effort to understand how can we protect this resource without getting sucked into a process we know has a predetermined outcome. So local citizens with the Chewitna Citizens Coalition on the west side of Cook Inlet several years ago filed to keep the water in Middle Creek. It's called a reservation of water, or an in-stream flow reservation. And it's simply there to say the water belongs in the stream for salmon and other wildlife.
On the other hand, Pakrim Kaul has filed for traditional water rights. Shady, for DNR, is currently considering the three applications from the Citizens Coalition.
So what we have now is a traditional water right that is behind a reviewable water right, and it creates a little bit of conflict.
The purpose of the public hearing is to gather more information on objections to the applications. On one side, there will be people who believe DNR underestimated the value of the fisheries that will be lost if the stream is destroyed. Two of the applications are in the footprint of the proposed mine area, while the third is not, which speaks to this group, says Shady.
In those instances, there's a direct conflict between a reservation of water and leaving the stream there and the ability or not to mine.
On the other side, there are those who believe it's not in the public interest to grant any reservation of water at this point in time. And the timeline isn't standard, says Shady. Typically, DNR would look at reservation of water versus traditional water rights at the end of the permitting process, once the mine is given the go-ahead.
So, unfortunately, I'm having to make certain assumptions that these permits will be granted, and I will clearly lay out what those assumptions are. But, you know, I'm going to have to assume that these things are going to be able to be put in place as part of my decision, or if I think they're not going to be put in place, depending on any further information I get.
In 2013, the Superior Court ruled that DNR had violated the Citizens Coalition's right to due process and hadn't followed the law when they allowed their water applications to sit for 4 years without consideration, hence the accelerated timeline. As part of that, DNR received more than 7,000 public comments on the applications. The majority came from people like Coalition member Judy Heilman, who wanted protection for salmon habitat.
There's never been a salmon stream that's been restored that's been destroyed like that. I can't tell you that how important it is for us to stop this before it starts.
But others were vehement that DNR should follow the standard permitting process.
What I see in the discussions is you have various groups with very specific viewpoints. You have the fisheries viewpoint, that they're very focused on that, and that's a very viable viewpoint to have. You have industry on the other side that has a viewpoint of trying to be able to develop resources. So it's a challenge. DNR is a multi-use agency. We have to balance all the uses. The good news is I have a statute which gives me criteria.
He says he'll follow that, and because reservation of water applications are reviewable, will likely return to the decision once again down the line. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
About 200 people in Juneau have joined forces to break the link between childhood trauma and suicide. They took part in a two-day suicide prevention conference last week. KTOO's Lisa Fu was there on day one, which focused on establishing the trauma-suicide link.
After analyzing data from state surveys on trauma and risky behaviors, Alice Rarig says she was taken aback.
It shocked me to see that 1 in 5 young people think about suicide, and that more than half of them have major problems with sadness or feeling alone or not having adults in their lives to talk to.
Rarig is a retired state health planner and a member of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition. She says she's also troubled by the amount of youth who've experienced bullying, violence, sexual abuse, and other traumatic experiences. The coalition identified childhood trauma to be a leading factor contributing to suicide in Juneau. Patrick Sidmore is a planner with the State Department of Health and Social Services. He helped coordinate the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study in Alaska. For the past 20 years, the national study has shown that traumatic experiences like abuse, neglect, or growing up with substance abuse may lead to serious health problems into adulthood.
In the original study, they looked at suicide attempts and adverse childhood experiences, and it had the strongest correlation of any of the items they looked at. For example, 80% of suicide attempts can be tied back to adverse childhood experiences. This is a rate that is similar to lung cancer and cigarette smoking.
Sidmore says many scientists think adverse childhood experiences actually cause suicide. He says addressing trauma will help prevent suicide. Shirley Pitts says one of the ways this can be done is examining the quality of relationships for kids. Pitts is an early childhood expert with the state's Office of Children's Services.
What are we doing to support families so that they can have good, nurturing relationships with kids? What kind of messages does our community give about the value of children? And, you know, all you need is somebody who cares about you, and that can get you through a lot. So how do we make sure that every kid has that?
The rate of suicide in Juneau is similar to the state's. There were 6 suicides in Juneau in 2013, similar numbers in prior years. It peaked in 2007 with 9. The Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition formed the following year. Walter Majoros is the coalition's chair. He's also the executive director of Juneau Youth Services. He says the number of suicides may have gone down, but
there are a lot of deaths that have occurred in recent years, particularly with people in their 20s that have been drug overdoses. So we have to look beyond the real numbers to what's actually happening. And so in that sense, I think there still are a lot of deaths that are occurring within our community that maybe aren't being labeled as suicide. But if you look a little deeper, I think they really are.
Coalition member Alice Rarig adds the numbers don't account for suicide attempts or suicidal plans and thoughts. She says preventing suicide means also preventing other bad things.
We'll probably reduce the fighting, the bullying, the unsafe sex, the self-harm through alcohol use and substances.
On day 2 of the conference, participants will focus on putting their knowledge to work on a community level. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A grease-smudged stack of 25 fading sheets of paper in a storage shed is one of only 2 copies of who's buried where in Juneau's Evergreen Cemetery. All the burials since 1986 are handwritten. Now, that's about to change. The city and borough of Juneau was recently awarded a grant to help map its graves digitally. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on bringing the dead online.
Ben Patterson has been overseeing the grounds at the Evergreen Cemetery for about 12 years. During that time, he's been able to reflect on where he'd like to spend his final days.
I definitely don't want to be put into the ground, I know that. I don't know if that's because I've spent so much time in a cemetery already. I think I'd rather be spread around a little bit.
Inside the cemetery storage shed, along with the gardening tools and a lawnmower, is an invaluable stack of papers.
It's basically 25 pages of maps that show all the plots. And these
it's one of only 2 known copies. The other is kept in a separate location to avoid both being destroyed in a fire. More than 8,000 people are buried at Evergreen. The cemetery dates back to the 1880s when it was moved from its original spot on Chicken Hill.
It was staked as a mining claim for gold, and so they had to move everyone that was there.
On the pages of the map are rectangular plots that look like...
Just kind of threw them out here like dice on some of these. And of course, there are sections where it's a lot more orderly.
And inside some of those rectangles are printed names, collected from a 1986 survey.
All the handwritten notes is just all the burials that had happened since then, or things that were discovered since then and had to be just written onto here.
Handwritten notes. It's not a great system. Patterson has almost all the grave sites memorized. He can flip through the 25 pages and find people by name.
Anyway, they're somewhere right by the road.
And he can also find them on the ground.
I was just mowing the other day and someone walked up and asked me where a certain person was. And I just happened to have just weed whipped around his headstone and I was able to walk right over and show them right where it was. And they were joking with me that I had all 8,000 graves memorized.
With the rise in genealogical databases like Ancestry.com, Patterson says he's noticed an increase in these requests. This week alone, he's located the graves of 5 different people. A new system will be a big help.
It is huge. It's going to mean that it's going to be way easier for people to find everyone in Evergreen from now on.
The city and borough of Juneau was awarded about a $17,000 grant in federal funds to put the cemetery map online.
And Joseph Juneau's been mapped.
Outside, city cartographer Quinn Tracy holds a GPS device above the headstones to pinpoint the exact geographic location.
So then when I bring these points into the geographic information systems, I'll have a point, and then I'll have a name associated with that point.
Buried at Evergreen are several notable people from Alaska's history. City co-founders Joe Juneau and Richard Harris, the victims from the sinking of Princess Sophia, and civil rights activist Elizabeth Paratrovich. Tracy only needs 2 coordinates per grid section to map the entire cemetery. The rest will be overlaid using a digital scan of the 1986 survey.
Let's see if we can read this.
Tracy peels back the moss from a crumbling headstone to uncover a name.
It's just kind of sad that some of these can't really read.
Pretty soon, family and friends will be able to search for gravesites on the city's website with just the click of a mouse.
It'll be similar in concept to Google Maps, where you enter an address and it takes you to that location. In this case, you'll enter somebody's name and it'll take you to their location in Evergreen Cemetery.
Most of the remaining plots were sold in the 1950s, and the site is almost full. Before long, there will be no new burials at Evergreen. A group of children nearby take turns tumbling down the hill. Groundskeeper Ben Patterson says he doesn't mind the historic resting place being treated like a park.
I don't find that disrespectful. I think it's one of the neatest things about our cemetery is that it's just so peaceful and people like it so much.
The Evergreen Cemetery map goes online in October. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Bedoni in Galena, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web producer. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.